Imagine earning continuing education credits while doing exactly what you're doing right now. Well, you can. Gable Media has revolutionized the way you earn your continuing education credits with a groundbreaking approach. Forget running around town and scouring the internet for credit-worthy courses. Fulfill your CE requirements effortlessly by listening to engaging podcasts just like the one you're listening to now. Our podcasts are designed to educate, entertain, and inspire, all in a user-friendly environment. But wait, there's more. Architects, Gable Media is also approved as an AIA Continuing Education Services provider. Upon completion, we handle everything, from reporting your hours directly to the AIA to storing your certificates in your personal Gable Media profile for your self-reporting needs. So follow the link in the show notes and start earning your credits in the most innovative and entertaining way possible with Gable Media.
My driver is helping people do better sooner because our architecture schools, in my opinion, are failing us, especially architecture schools, but engineering schools just as much. Even construction management schools probably get it the best. Had I known a lot of the things earlier that I know now, that I could have known earlier, it would have been such a game changer for me to have gotten that education much earlier in my career. And I feel a responsibility to give back what I've been given.
Welcome to Context and Clarity, the place where authors, experts, and thought leaders come to have engaged conversations with entrepreneurial architects just like you. I'm Jeff Eccles, and every Tuesday afternoon on Context and Clarity Live, my co-host Katie Kangas and I, and our live audiences that join us from all across the internet, we have a conversation with a special guest to search for clarity around the things that matter most to you, the architect, no matter what your context is. In this episode, we talk with the CSI Kraken herself, Charisse Lakeside. Charisse is a mentor and a teacher. She's the senior spec writer at RDH Building Science, and she's the host of RCAT's Detailed podcast. All right. Welcome back to Context and Clarity Live. If you're new around here, you probably don't realize any difference. But if you're a longtime Context and Clarity Live participant, I'm going to say it's a new date and time. This is our third week, I think, in this new time slot. And I am joined by my co-host, Katie Kanga. So welcome, Katie. Glad that you're here with us all the way from
Minnesota.
Minnesota. Like we talked about this last week. We were kind of we're anchoring the middle of the country here. We've got a guest back in the green room. You know, based on that nickname, I would think they're probably busting out of the green room by now. We're going to have to release the Kraken. But our guest today is a mentor, a teacher, and a speaker. She's a tweeter, definitely a tweeter, and a board member. She's a senior spec writer for RDH Building Science, the Hans William Meyer Award winner for innovation of certification programs. She is the CSI Kraken, and she's the host of RCAT's podcast. And if you've been around here at all, you know that RCAT is a friend of Entree Architect and everything architecture, really. So she is the host of the RCAT podcast, Detailed. Charisse Lakeside, welcome to Context and Clarity Live.
Good morning, or morning here, at least.
It is morning there. Thanks for getting
up. Thank you for having me. Oh, it's not that early in the morning.
I know.
Nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here. And you and I have known each other for a long time, been friends for a long time. So it's fun to have you on the show. I want to go back because a lot of us know the nickname CSI Kraken. Where did that come from? Where did that nickname come from?
It's really a silly story. I came into CSI super, super late in my career. Raising a family, everything that went along with that, I didn't think I had the time. And so I joined CSI a little over 11 years ago. And by taking the CDT course, that's what kind of, they're really good in Portland CSI of noticing who looks semi-interested in something and getting you involved very quickly. So before I was done with that CDT course, I hadn't even been to a chapter meeting. My instructor, who became one of my mentors and the person who put me up for fellowship, came up to me and said, "You need to be on the board." I'm like, "I don't even know you people. I haven't even been to a meeting yet." "No, we need you on the board." And so within the first year, I was on the board of Portland CSI, and we were having a conversation, and I don't know how much time you've spent around a bunch of spec writers, but sometimes when you get a bunch of them in a room, we could have some rather lengthy conversations about things. And I'm kind of an efficiency expert, like, let's just get her done. So, you know, I had been quiet the first couple board meetings. So I was like, "Hey, you know, can I share an idea?" And just started saying, "How about you do this and you do this and you do this, I'll do this, we're done, bam, let's move on. Does that sound good?" And the president at the time, lovely gentleman, muttered under his breath, "Oh my God, release the Kraken." And it just stuck. So then I started tweeting with hashtag CSI Kraken because I thought it was funny. And it took on a life of its own. So now there are actually CSI Kraken all over the country. There are chapters that give out CSI Kraken awards. It was never meant to be about me. I just have the biggest mouth out of all of them. But we just started our own little movement. People who kind of just kind of step up, get things done, was the intent behind it. I just have the biggest mouth. So, and the hashtag. So that's how I got the name. That's how I got the name. It's like, we got to get this stuff done faster, people.
Yeah,
And we have. The chapter's done some amazing things.
Yeah. Well,
so that's where it comes from.
So that's a really interesting story. I mean, you pass the CDT, or you go through the CDT, and before you're even really involved in the chapter, now all of a sudden, you know, I don't know what the time frame is here, but it seems like a few weeks or months, all of a sudden you're the CSI Kraken. There's obviously a lot of involvement between the CDT, being a fellow, you know, at large on the board now. Why stay involved for so long? Why immerse yourself in that particular? I mean, I know that particular association aligns directly with your day job, so to speak, but what you do, but why so much involvement over all the years?
Well, I joke that CSI is the best kept secret in the industry. A lot of people, when I mention something about CSI, their first reaction is, I'm not a spec writer. I don't need that. And they don't truly understand what we do in CSI, which is we don't just teach spec writing. We teach project delivery education from cradle to grave. And so in CSI, unlike many organizations, any discipline is an equal member at the table. So we have all disciplines. I tell the young professionals that I mentor, if you're an architect, join AIA. You got to learn your craft somewhere. Then join CSI so you actually know how to do the business of architecture, or at least a good portion of the business of delivering a project. So when I go to a CSI meeting and say I'm working through a problem, or I don't know something because I don't know a lot of things, I feel like I know less and less every morning when I wake up. I can ask a question at a CSI meeting, and I've got a contractor standing there. I have an architect standing there. I have an engineer standing there. And I get such a deeper perspective of having multiple disciplines. I'm not in a tunnel in CSI. That and the people are flipping amazing. They really are. I officiated my first CSI wedding last year, and I'm officiating another one this summer. Because I'm an ordained minister. There's something I bet you didn't know. Not religious in the least bit. So I get a little scared of getting struck by lightning running around calling myself a minister. But they're just some really incredible people. And because there's no competition, there's all the disciplines are there and everybody leaves it outside the door. It's just a different relationship. And I would not have accomplished anything that I've accomplished in the last 10 years had it not been for the people in that organization. I'm not saying I didn't do the work. I'll take credit for doing the work, but they empowered me and saw things in me and supported me when I couldn't see them myself. And you just can't get that everywhere. And that's why, I mean, I'm able to, they also let me just run amok. In Portland CSI, I just, you know, because I'm not on the Portland CSI board anymore, but I'll email them and say, "Hey, I have this idea." They're like, "Do your thing, Sharice." Just whatever. Go ahead. Let us know what you need. Some pretty incredible. It's the people more than anything else in this organization that I can't imagine not being a part of it. And I can't sit around and not do anything with anything that I am a part of. So that's my why for CSI.
Love it. I was listening to your podcast and I had not found it yet. So I really appreciate detailed on RCAT, and you really just have amazing conversations. And what you seem to be doing is closing that gap of knowledge where architects make documents and set them out there to be built. But you're wanting to close that gap because so much is learned in the field. And as a young architect, it's really hard to get that ocean of knowledge. There's just endless amounts of information that we can gather. And so I really appreciate how you've been doing that. The problem is very apparent, but what first turned you on to wanting to solve that information disconnect?
My journey through this industry is really unconventional. I actually started working in architecture as a receptionist, and I worked for three men, which back in that period of time, we won't discuss which decade that was. I worked for three men, much older than me, that in an era where this wasn't typically the case, they did not care that I was female and they did not care that I was 20 years old. They cared that I was smart, and I was constantly saying, but why do we do that? Show me how to do that. And so I am truly a trained in the trenches spec writer. And I was at that first firm for 22 years, and I wore every hat in that firm. The only thing I didn't do was draw. I am not a designer. Don't pretend to be an architect. Not even close. Not sure that I would ever want to be either, but I've worn every other hat. And then when they had to close their doors in 2008 with the recession, I went to work for an MEP engineer. So cross to the dark side is how I joke around, or the light side, depending on how you want to look at it. And I learned from crossing over and working in a different discipline, all the things I was doing wrong on the architecture side in the way I was working with my consultants. I got this completely different vision. And had I not had all of that support and all those people that would teach me things, because I didn't go to college even. So I really learned on the job. And so it's important for me. I know how valuable that was for me to get that real life education. So lessons learned, whether it's teaching the CDT or doing the podcast, all those nuggets of information that I gained over the year were game changers for me in how I worked throughout my career. And I'm still getting them every day from somebody. So that's kind of my driver, is helping people do better sooner, because our architecture schools, in my opinion, are failing us, especially architecture schools, but engineering schools just as much. Even construction management schools probably get it the best. Had I known a lot of the things earlier that I know now, that I could have known earlier, I would be running the world.
No doubt.
I don't know about that, but it would have been such a game changer for me to have gotten that education much earlier in my career. And I feel a responsibility to give back what I've been given.
It was incredible. Before we were on live, you said how many students you had with your CDT course? Over 800?
I don't have all the records. I estimate somewhere between 700 and 900 in the last 10 years.
That's incredible.
My last class was my record breaker, 104 all over the United States and a few outside of the United States. The project delivery, you have to deliver a project. It doesn't matter where you live. And nobody's teaching anybody that anywhere else. People are like, you know, why are you selling CSI? You're not going to get it anywhere else, my friends. They're the only ones. There's other organizations that teach pieces and parts. But to get the whole picture and understand those relationships and where your risk is, it truly is a game changer. And, you know, how do we learn right now? Outside of design, how do you learn right now? It's trial by fire education. You screw up and your boss gets mad and you figure out why you don't ever want to do that again. I don't think we have to do as much of that in our industry. So I go out there and rope people into my class whenever I can. And I actually get some of them. They spend 12 weeks with me, 2 hours a week. But we have a lot of CDTs out there, and I'm super, super proud of.
So you said that architecture schools are failing. and we could do a whole show on that. you know, that's, we could go real deep on that real fast, but I'm with you on that. What's the biggest thing that needs to change in, we'll just stick with, you mentioned engineering schools and construction management as well. And I know a lot of, so for instance, at Ball State, where I teach, like a lot of universities, they're bringing many of the disciplines under the same umbrella. But if you could make one fundamental change in these curriculums, you know, pick out whatever school, or I mean, just it's all NAB, right? So what would be the one fundamental change that you would make? Or you can pick two or three if you like.
You know, that's an easy one for me. It would be having this project delivery education for any discipline. If I was queen of the world, and I do have a crown on my desk when I need it, you would not be allowed to work in this industry if you didn't have project delivery education. Some of the most basic pieces of knowledge. I get a lot of young people in my class. A lot of them are studying for their AREs. Some are fresh out of school. I even get some that are in school. But they come out of school with basically zero knowledge of how to protect yourself, how to protect your firm, what is your responsibility and what you shouldn't touch. And so much inefficiency and so many mistakes are made. We're talking, it could be one class for one term. And the education is already there. CSI fights with colleges constantly trying to get this into their curriculum in the architecture schools, most specifically because the architect is the hub of the wheel on the project. So you hit them first. Most of them just don't want anything to do with it. We're here to teach you how to design. Well, great. You can make pretty pictures. No offense, architects. But then the biggest payout I've ever personally seen at a firm that I worked for on a mistake in a project was $1 million out of pocket. Now, that was their deductible. It was actually more than that, but that's what they had to pay out of pocket. Here's your first test, your first quiz. What was the fee on that project, the design fee on that project?
$1 million, no.
No, $1 million was their deductible. It was more than that, the total payout to fix this mistake.
Ooh, sadly. I think it was only like $400,000, but that's like, I try to write in my documents, like, I'm only liable for what you've paid me for. But once it goes to court, I think that goes out the window.
It does go out the window. $3,500. Understanding where your risk is and who's responsible for what is critical, but yet they give you none of that in architecture school. And engineers get zero. Some people will argue with me, no, I had a professional practice class. Yeah, and I bet you they talked all about marketing and that kind of that end of the business of architecture, but not actually, there's zero in contract documents, yet what you're held to legally are your drawings and your specs, and they're equal in the eyes of the law. And precedent statements in your contracts don't get you anywhere either. So, you know, that's something that if it was up to me, you would not be able to work in this industry without that base. And that's still kindergarten in our industry, but at least you're dangerous enough to ask the right questions. That's my goal, to make you all dangerous enough to ask the right questions.
Release the Kraken. we've got to say hello to Christian because he said writing specs made me late for writing about writing or for learning about writing specs. So Christian, welcome. Glad you showed up. For this conversation. Charisse, if you don't know Christian, he's a spec writer based in Ithaca, New York. So
I do know who you are. But yeah, I have people in my class who've been in the business 35 years that they're going, I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that. And somehow, you know, but I've never had a problem. That's another great statement. But I've never had a problem with it when I tell them, you can't do that. You cannot do that. You're putting yourself at risk. Well, I've never had a problem. Until you have a problem.
Right.
So, you know, is it worth it for you to keep risking that over something that's so easy to fix? And mm-hmm. I'll be perfectly honest, a lot of our contract documents are grossly inefficient because people don't actually follow the standards. They create work they don't even have to have. That's my two cents. You asked.
Oh, well, this conversation around risk is it hits the core because it's often what drives people to do or not do certain things. And I hear a lot about it, especially former firms, like, oh, we don't do that. We can't risk it. And learning to knowledgeably manage that risk seems to be where the power is. I'm curious what the next step is. You've empowered these people with your class. They go out into their projects, but everyone else on their project, you talk about the architect as the hub. What is their first step for onboarding the rest of the team?
Well, you know, and that's a difficult one because it kind of depends on the environment and how empowering their firm is. You know, I have a lot of young professionals that struggle to have any kind of voice in their firms, and other ones where I had a couple that were in my class the last round from a firm all the way across the country in Philly called me up and said, if we could convince the bosses to fly you out here to do some teaching, would you do it? And I'm like, Philly? Yeah. Cheesesteak? Okay. I'll come to Philly. And their bosses have decided to wait a while. So we'll see if they'll actually do it over the long run. But what usually happens is it's just like when you do a random act of kindness, there's a ripple effect that you never see. The same thing happens if you can get one person in a firm to get the base knowledge, and all of a sudden they're questioning things that nobody's ever questioned before. They're pulling out their CDT textbook and going, here, it says it right here. You can't do that. A submittal is not a contract document. Did you know that? Do you know how many people don't know that? And so they get a submittal and they mark it up and they make a change to the project and send it back. That's not a contractually accepted change because that's not a recognized vehicle to change the contract. So if that thing you just changed on that submittal fails, guess what? The architect just took on the contractor's risk by making that change on the submittal and not doing it with something like a change order. There's so many of that type of thing that people don't know. So they go in and they challenge their bosses. I would say a huge chunk of my students these days are in my class because somebody else they know took my class or somebody they respect said, you need to take Charisse's class. Right now, that's the only step we have is to try and get the word out there more, which is why I tweet so much. Since I heard your intro, she's a tweeter. I tweet a little less these days just because Twitter's a little bit of a dumpster fire at the moment. Hopefully that'll change again. But really, that's I'm one person. There are other chapters all over the country that do teach a CDT. I want people to know is that CSI is not for speculators. CSI is for every single person in the industry, because just getting that change in mindset, I think, will bring more people to the table to get that education, because it will be the single most valuable thing they do, and they'll use it the entire rest of their career, whether that's 10 years or 30 or 40.
Yeah, that's an important point, and I'm sure that's lost on a lot of people. It's CSI, it's specifications, but obviously so much more. So what was the path between, you know, CSI, CDT, CSI, and all of your involvement there, and then now RCAT and the detailed podcast? How did that come about? How did the podcast itself come about?
The path has been a crazy one. About the time I joined CSI, shortly after that, my youngest son left for college. So the last kid was out of the house. And all these things I didn't have time to do before in my career, I could do. I could do whatever I wanted. And so I did all the things. I did all the things. Started speaking, got really involved in CSI, went beyond the chapter board. I was chaired some institute committees for a while, eventually was on the institute board for a few years, going to all the conferences and started speaking. And the more I was speaking, I started speaking more. Total nut job on social media, LinkedIn. Mostly LinkedIn and Twitter. And so I started getting to know some people like you and Mark LePage and Demetrius and, you know, just peripherally. And I got a call, and then I was part of an effort a few years back that we called Let's Fix Construction. And the website is still up, and we were getting guest blogs from people about, again, lessons learned and things in the industry that needed to be fixed. And we also did a very, for me, it was a fairly short stint in podcasting, but podcasting is a lot of work and, you know, and busy schedules and stuff. And so there was did that for a while. And I got a call one day from, or an email from Mark saying, you know, we'd like, do you think you might possibly be interested in hosting a podcast, and would you like to talk about it? And I'm looking at an email, looking around like, who's he talking to? You know? And so we had a meeting and I'm like, Mark, you know me, right? I just want to make sure you know what you're asking for here. And we talked about it. And then we had, I decided that sounds interesting and kind of fun, especially since Gable Media is doing all the heavy lifting, you know, doing all of the production and editing and all of that. And so then we had a meeting with the head honchos over at RCAT, and it was kind of funny. And I said, here's my thing. If you guys are really like just wanting this perfectly well-behaved, you know, Barbara Walters, I just want to make sure that you know me, because it's not going to be me. I just want to have real conversations with real people. I want to know the challenges they had on their projects and how they solved them. And I don't want to feel like I have to constantly check myself or be worried. I want to look into their eyes and get all the knowledge. And they're like, nope, we're all good. And so we decided, let's do 10 episodes and see what happens. And now we're over 50 episodes. And I don't know, somewhere it seemed to be working for people, and we're having some great conversations talking about real things. And I think that's why it's going so well. We're resonating with people, because there's a lot of podcasts out there where you can tell me about your pretty building, and there's a place for those too. Absolutely. But that's not the podcast I wanted to have. I want to hear about your pretty building, but I want to hear about all the things that went wrong getting to your pretty building. And how did you become a better professional, and how'd you fix it? And I tell my guests before we start, my goal by the end of this podcast, and you resonated with me when we were talking before we started this, my goal is to have at least one person run from their computer to their desk and go, I'm going to go fix this because of what I just heard. Even if it's just one, but we have almost 100,000 somebody's listening to this thing. So that's just kind of, I just seem to keep falling into these opportunities. But I have to say that this, I wasn't really sure. I don't know if I ever told Mark this, and I know he's on here somewhere, so I'm about to out myself. I wasn't really sure I wanted to do this, to be perfectly honest. And so I was really pleased that it was we'll just do 10. I am a total addict. I get to meet some of the coolest people, which is what I love about doing it, and hear interesting stories and some personal things too, because I always throw a couple of crazy questions in there. You know, when I interviewed a gentleman named Collie Hodges from the Houston Zoo, my first question to him is, if you could be any animal, what would you be? You know, and then of course the world not domination question at the end of the podcast. Every single guest gets that question. You know, what is your world domination statement? Because that's another hashtag, total world domination. That's my goal. So, you know, I don't know how I fall into this stuff, except for I think I have sucker written across my head in really large letters. And they know Charisse isn't probably going to say no, although I'm getting better at that. I'm picking and choosing. But I like doing things that give me joy. And teaching CDT gives me joy. And doing this podcast gives me joy. And not that I want their heads to get big or anything, but Mark and Demetrius are pretty awesome people to work with. And again, they totally let me do me. I sent out, you know, they got a message from me recently. We need t-shirts. We need t-shirts that say Gable Stable. They're just, I'm sure they're at their desks rolling their eyes almost every time I sent a message. It's like, okay, sure, so whatever. They're a pretty great team to work with, and they make me sound really smart, and the guests are happy and they feel the same way. So if you're enjoying it, you should be doing it, correct?
I love that you shared that you started your career by asking questions. And I love that about the podcast, that you do seem to find niche areas and you dive into the technical details that would improve someone's daily practice. And you do seem to get to that deeper level that it's so hard. There's so much information to skim over. It's hard to dive deep and find those little nuggets. So I do find it very valuable in that way.
I'm hyper-focused on that, because that's really what I want to know. Again, I can go listen to 100 podcasts about somebody's pretty building. And I really shouldn't say this either. I'm not much of a podcast listener. So it's really mind-blowing to me that almost 100,000 people are listening to mine. That's what I want to know. I want to know how you got there, because my whole career has been finding a way to get there on my own, figuring it out. And people who would answer those questions for me when I couldn't figure it out. So I want them to answer those questions for other people. So I'm looking for those things. It's a little hard sometimes because I'm not an architect. I'm like, I have no idea what you just said, but that sounded really good. But that's the goal, hopefully, is for people to learn. I'm loving doing it, though. So they're stuck with me until they boot me out the door.
Sounds like that would actually be hard to do.
Kraken has lots of ways to hold on.
Imagine earning continuing education credits while doing exactly what you're doing right now. Well, you can. Gable Media has revolutionized the way you earn your continuing education credits with a groundbreaking approach. Forget running around town and scouring the internet for credit-worthy courses. Fulfill your CE requirements effortlessly by listening to engaging podcasts just like the one you're listening to now. Our podcasts are designed to educate, entertain, and inspire, all in a user-friendly environment. But wait, there's more. Architects, Gable Media is also approved as an AIA Continuing Education Services provider. Upon completion, we handle everything, from reporting your hours directly to the AIA to storing your certificates in your personal Gable Media profile for your self-reporting needs. So follow the link in the show notes and start earning your credits in the most innovative and entertaining way possible with Gable Media.
What you're saying about, you know, these are the stories. This is what you want to know, right? This is your exploration. This is what you're curious about. And I think, you know, that's what we all want, right? We all want the story. We all want this exploration, you know. And I think, you know, going back to the beginning of your story, you didn't even go to college. This, I think, is the way you said it. But yet here you are, right? You've asked the questions and you've learned the things and you've put in the work and you've developed the skills and now you're sharing all of those things. And I think that's a journey that can resonate with a lot of people. You know, there's obviously there are going to be a lot of people in this audience that did go to college and, you know, have degrees in architecture and whatnot, but they've still experienced the struggle of coming up in the profession. And I think that's a lot of the value that you share. And I love the format. You know, I love what you're doing with Detailed, because you're exactly right. I could tell you that, you know, I worked on some project, you know, back when I actually did architecture, worked on some project. Great. Who cares? You know, so did everybody else. Worked on a museum project. So did a lot of other people. What's unique about that museum? What stand out about that museum? And you know, one of my favorite stories about a museum that I worked on was being just this junior person in the office. Somebody walked up to me one day and handed me a napkin, like a literal napkin sketch with the concept of a stair on it. And, you know, I was 25 years old or something, you know, full of attitude and something, but I looked at that and went, what am I supposed to do with this? Right. And what I was supposed to do is figure it out, take that, turn it into the actual stair in this museum. And at the time, I didn't appreciate that. Now I really wish I had that napkin. Now, I didn't go to that project. It was in Chicago, and I moved out of Chicago before the construction was complete. I didn't go back to that project and see it for about 10 or 12 years. And when I was researching that, going to this museum, I found out that that stair is the most photographed piece of this entire project. All of a sudden, that's really cool. That's really meaningful to me, right? But it's those little stories that you're pulling out of these, you know, of the different projects, of the different buildings. I think that's why it resonates so well with people, and why 100,000 people want to listen to these stories. It's almost like the backstage pass in a way, right? They're getting what they wouldn't see.
But that's the parts I want to hear. I mean, I've actually had three episodes that made me cry. I was so touched by that. A particular one is the Cook School, and I'm drawing a blank on the firm name right now. Oh, I feel horrible. Somebody, Mark, look it up and put it on the chat. The Cook School in New York. It's a school specifically designed for kids with special needs, predominantly autism, but other special needs as well. And I have a nephew on the spectrum. And I navigated special education with my stepson and the fight to get what he needed in school to actually succeed and learn. And they talked to me about the lengths that they went to to get the funding for this school, and then the lengths that they went to design a school that these kids need in spaces that they need, and right down to colors that were chosen and textures and lighting and acoustics, because noise is sometimes an issue for some kids on the spectrum. And I was just so touched by, you know, but dragging out like, wait, I really wanted some details on that school because it really, you know, touched a personal chord with me. But I'm also hoping that somewhere along the way, I'm empowering some younger professionals to ask questions, because I hear more often than anything from my younger students, somebody will ask me a question and they'll preface it with, can I ask you something? Because I don't want to ask my boss. I don't want to sound stupid. I am the queen of asking stupid questions. And that's the first thing that I tell them. There is no stupid question. I will ask it. I don't care how dumb I look, because I need the answer. And if I get the answer, I'm going to do my job better. But unfortunately, not every firm is particularly empowering to their young professional. I'm not saying you have to do it for them. I love your napkin sketch story, because I love stuff like that. Just give it to me. Let me figure it out. And when I can't, if there's something I can't, then I'll come to you. I have no problem with that. Thank you, PBDW Architects. But there are a lot of young professionals that are not given an environment that empowers them to ask. They feel like, oh, I might not be the next one promoted if I ask this and I look stupid. There should be huge signs hanging in every firm that says there is no stupid question. And so sometimes I ask stupid questions on the podcast, probably regularly, and I don't even realize it some of the time. So that's a little kind of passive aggressive thing I'm hoping to accomplish is it's okay to ask. What's the worst thing that's going to happen?
Can I ask?
Sure, go ahead.
How have specifications changed to accommodate a different design process, like integrated project delivery or design build? Because I see the specs, I did them a lot in a design bid build firm. And now I'm out on my own, and they are kind of integrated into the documents as best as I can, because I don't often get contractors who read a spec book. And so putting them on the drawings, making them, I know this is hitting a lot of tropes here. So where to start?
I've got trauma response going on here that I have. I do a 2-hour kind of, I call it Let's Talk About Specs, Baby course. And in the sidebar of some of my slides are statements I can't stand. And one of them is the contractor won't read the specs. And so I'll tell you the reason the contractor doesn't read the specs. And I know exactly why. It's because we don't do our documents properly. Specs and drawings are two pieces you need to build your building. Specs show your qualitative requirements. Drawings show your quantitative. If your documents are done correctly, your contractor has no choice but to read your specs. What we do is what I call CYA behavior. We put all this spec language on our drawings because the contractor's not going to read their spec and I have to have them see it. Another cornerstone of spec writing is say it once and say it in the right place. So if you have a piece of information and it belongs in one place, it's going to be either on the specs or on the drawings, depending on the type of information. There's no way any contractor can build a building without reading them both. And so that's where that problem comes from. The specs don't change from one project delivery to another, at least not the technical specs. Your front end is what changes from one project delivery method to another, depending on the contract model. And there are advanced certifications as well in CSI to really deep dive into construction contracts and that language, and also into specification writing. But it's just, some of it you're going to get, even CSI can't give you everything. No organization can give you everything. You're going to get out there and learn, understanding that if you move to this other project delivery method, the whole front end is going to have to change to work in concert with the agreements and the general conditions. Then at least you know where to start asking questions. I made friends with a whole bunch of spec writers as well. So there's people all over the country I can call and say, okay, I'm going to sound like a moron, but I don't know what I'm doing here. What do I do? We're real good in CSI about helping other people, because that's what we're here to do, is to make the whole delivery process better. If your drawings and specs are done correctly, you won't do those 3,000 RFIs during construction.
That'd be great. But how do specs work if you're doing a design build project?
You know, The contracts change and the Division I changes on who's instructing what, but the technical sections don't change.
You bring them in right away. And yeah,
I mean, if it's design build, say it's a mechanical firm and it's a design build firm, then they're going to be the prime. So there's going to be differences in the front end, but the technical sections for a project are the technical sections. That's what you need to do the job. So it's all the contractual requirements up front that you have to address if you change to different project delivery. Anything else? I'm happy to. I'm here all day.
Yeah. In one of your earlier podcasts, you talked about some sort of checklists for QAQC to kind of help with that, recapturing that backend information with CA and bringing that back into the specs. As a sole practitioner or some of the small practitioners on this call, what kind of checklist, where do we start as small firms with those checklists? Are there good resources from CSI to start with?
So I think I know what you're talking about. So the checklist I'm talking about is something I created just for my use. And I created that when I went from architecture to MEP engineering. There's all these places where we have things that cross paths between one consultant or another and the architect that have to be coordinated. And those are the things that, and the easiest example is access panel. You know, it's probably the number one thing that goes wrong every time. It's the architect's job to specify access panels, but MEP equipment often needs special access panels. Engineer doesn't know that even what Division 8 is, let alone there's an access panel section in it. So they go put an access panel in their specs. Architect's supposed to do that. So architect goes and puts an access panel in their specs. Well, there's two different access panels. So here's at the very least an RFI, probably a change order because contractor probably bid the cheaper one and we probably want the more expensive one. Or better yet, both of them leave it out. Architect doesn't put it in theirs because MEP always does it, even though they're not supposed to. There's a whole list of things like that. Fireproofing. Where does the pipe end for the building and start? You know, where does civil's pipe end and the building's pipe? Where do they come together? There's another one that breaks down all the time. Voltages for equipment. You know, it's not just MEP. There's things with civil, things with different consultants that need to be coordinated. And people always forgot to do it. So when I was working in MEP, I created a checklist for the project managers. Here's all the things in MEP specs that you need to call the architect and say, I need half an hour of your time. What are we doing here? What are we doing here? Here's the access panel I want. Put it in your Division 8 access panel section because where's the sub going to look for it when they're bidding? They're going to look in Division 8. They're not going to look buried in Division 23 somewhere where mechanical equipment is. And there are some of those things when you said, you know, where do we go next? Some of those things you can just teach by doing. When I created that checklist, I got the senior principals to buy off on every PM had to. Their bonuses were dependent on a couple of different things, but one was that they took that checklist and called the architect on every project and coordinated all the items on that list. Another one was that they got a QA review of their documents before the final set went on the streets. We set up a whole system for doing that with fresh eyes on a different team, and they would bleed all over it. And I actually kept a spreadsheet of every PM and all their projects and who got their QA reviews done and who didn't. And that was given to the principals. You know, I don't know what happened to it when they did it, but it was part of the evaluation for their bonuses at the end of the year because those QA reviews were so important to have that. Those fresh eyes look over the whole set before it went out. There's no way to even quantify how much money was saved by doing that. But I saw how they'd often come back and some engineer, senior engineer only, could review them, bled all over those documents. And then they came back to the team, they fixed them, then they went out on the street. There'd be no way to even add up what kind of litigation that may have saved or just the time suck that can be CA if you don't have good documents.
This is resonating a lot. When I was at a 20-person firm once a month, one person would do a CA review and lessons learned in the field so that we could have lunch together and learn from one another. Another once a month thing was like Revit lessons and how to improve practice. So anyone doing Revit came and had lunch together and we shared. And it's the sharing of stories that helps these details stick. So it's really great to hear how you're doing that. Sorry, Jeff, I kind of hijacked this as a personal spec writing lesson. my last question is, when is the book coming out?
No, No book. With the advent of social media, I've got the attention span of a gnat. That's what I wanted to be when I was young. I wanted to be a writer and I wanted to travel all over the world. And
I thought you were going to say a gnat.
No. No, I don't want to be a gnat. I wanted to travel all over the world and write human interest stories. And so, you know, people ask me all the time, well, why don't you go do that? Well, now I don't have the patience to write, but I kind of get to do this with my podcast, with our cat's podcast, but that getting to be the host of this podcast, I kind of get to do that. And we may be talking about buildings, but I'm getting to know these people too. I have standing invites in a number of cities now. If you're in town, Charisse, let's have lunch. I'll go show you the building. You know, so yeah, I am not writing a book. And I saw that, Mark. No book. No book.
I'm glad you sort of caught yourself there, because I think it's not a book, right? But the podcast, you know, that idea of writing human interest stories. I mean, that's really, in my mind, that's what you're doing with the podcast, is you're like you said, the pretty building, but you're pulling the human interest story out of that project. It's narrow around the materials and the products and the details, et cetera. But it is a human interest story about the project. And so I think you've accomplished your goal there. That's fantastic.
Well, I believe that, you know, it's kind of funny. As long as I've worked in this industry, I used to be irritated. I'd go to a conference, you know, and I'm there with a bunch of architects and we'd all go out to lunch somewhere. And you couldn't walk one block without them stopping every 3 seconds to look at some stupid thing on a building. It's like, I'm hungry. But over time, and the more I've gotten involved in this business and the more that I have come to learn and understand more, buildings really do. And I don't know, maybe I'm just a bigger marshmallow now than I've ever been, but I have walked into the first building that ever moved me to the point of tears was St. Peter's in Vatican City. I didn't think that was possible. It's just a building, right? It's just sticks and concrete and whatever, but that's not the case. And that, I think, is kind of an epiphany moment that there's more to what we do than just putting up these sticks and concrete. People have to live and be in that space. And so the people behind designing those buildings do matter. Another one that I did recently that was amazing, Brooks and Scarpa did this building called The Six. It won awards, The Six, on Skid Row in Los Angeles. This is one of the ones that made me cry. And they just happened to be here just this last week in Portland for our Portland CSI annual industry forum. They were our keynote speakers. So I got to meet them in person after doing the podcast a few months ago. But we got into this big conversation. You know, this The Six is this very modern cube looking thing that does not look like affordable housing for veterans and formerly homeless people. You know, it's just not what people normally do. You know, it's just like, here's this box as cheap as you can get it. And this is a really notable looking building. And so we talked about that. And, I don't listen to my own podcast, so I don't know how much made the final cut because I think I sound terrible in all of them. But they told me about the work and effort they put into actually meeting with the homeless community. Like one of the things that they had done is moved the courtyard from street level. They had this big outdoor space. And the community that they were meeting with, the veterans and the formerly homeless people, told them, we wouldn't feel safe with the courtyard there because it's just, you could just walk right up from the street and the building's on Skid Row. So they moved this big outdoor space to the second floor so that it could be secured from people walking by on the street. Everything that they did in this building was very much with the humans that would be living there in mind and what would make them feel safe and secure and feel like they mattered. Those kinds of stories, you start looking at buildings in a different way when you get the people behind them, where all of a sudden now you can see the heart behind what you're looking at in front of you. So that, yeah, I get my warm fuzzy fix out of pretty much every episode.
Well, that's good. I'm glad that you do. And I'm glad that you're pulling these human interest stories out of the podcast. I think that's really important. I think that's why it's popular. So I know we're a few minutes past time, but if you've got another minute, maybe the last question is, what's on the bucket list? What's a project or a building or a firm that you would really love to have as a guest that you just haven't gotten yet?
Okay, so I call it my adventure list, just so you know. Bucket list sounds like you're going to die tomorrow. So I like to call it my adventure list. Of course, that includes a lot of things besides, believe it or not, on occasion, I do have a life outside of this industry. Maybe not as much as I should. Oh, man, that's a hard question because I've kind of just been tackling everything I want to tackle. I would love to be able to travel more and speak more to people in person. I mean, I was doing a lot of public speaking before COVID hit, and it's just now starting to pick up again. But the piece I'm really missing right now is seeing people more in person, you know, workshops, maybe. I don't know, because I'm kind of just doing it when I want to do it or a new opportunity comes up. I'm not being afraid of it. And I'm just, this wasn't on my list, but I'm loving every minute of it. And it just kind of came out of nowhere. I don't know. Maybe Mark was drinking that.
Tackling.
Is he still online? I don't know. I don't really, I'm very much a in the now kind of person these days. I've been a planner. I'm still a planner, but I've been a, you know, figure things out 10 years advance person most of my life. And I kind of just roll with the punches right now. So I don't know if I could answer that. I can't think of any one big thing unless, you know, that the whole queen of the world thing that stays on my list.
Well, there's that, but you've got to put the crown back on. But I think that in itself is a good lesson, right? You're rolling with it. You're not being afraid of it. You mentioned before saying no, and you know, just a reminder that in our contracts we set boundaries, right? So that's where the no might come in. But I'm really glad you're doing what you're doing, because I think the podcast itself is unique, and I think it's great, and I think, I mean, it's obvious that you're making a huge impact, not only in the industry, but especially with younger people in the industry and in the future of where all of this is headed. So I appreciate you for having this conversation with us and for the podcast and everything that you're doing as a teacher and mentor. It's just fantastic. And it's great to see you. I'll see you in San Francisco, by the way. But
yes.
But it's AIA. Great to see you here. Absolutely.
I'm trying to convince them to do because there's going to be, RCAT's going to be doing some things at the booth, and I'll be at the RCAT booth if anybody wants to come say hi. I was trying to convince them that they should do like a Where's Waldo thing, but a Where's the Kraken thing, and like give prizes to people who can find me in San Francisco when I'm not at the booth.
It's game on.
Yeah, game on. Where's the Kraken? So much for having me. This was fun. And I haven't seen you in forever. So it was really nice to get to say hi and talk. See you soon. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Charisse. This is great.
Well, what do you think? Did you hear something in this conversation that you can use, maybe in your practice or even in your life? If the topic of this conversation is of particular interest to you, every week in the Entree Architect Network, I host the Context and Clarity Classroom. It's our weekly opportunity to take what we've learned from our special guests and put those lessons into action in your life and in your work. Find the Context and Clarity Classroom exclusively inside the Entree Architect Network at network.entrearchitect.com. And if you are so inspired by this conversation that you'd like to watch the entire Context and Clarity Live episode, head on over to YouTube. Find the Entree Architect YouTube channel. There's a playlist there that has all of the full Context and Clarity Live episodes. You can also have the Context and Clarity podcast delivered to you every week. Just give us a rating and subscribe wherever you're listening right now. Your likes and your ratings and your shares all help us help other entrepreneur architects like you. And together, they help us build the largest worldwide community of small firm architects. And if you love content like this, check out Gable Media. It's a multimedia network for people that care about the built environment. And it's the home of Context and Clarity. With Gable's growing family of podcasts and video channels, I know that you're going to find something there that interests you. You can learn more at GableMedia.com. That's GableMedia.com. So thanks for listening. I hope this conversation has inspired you to think about how you can build your business into something that allows you to practice the way that you want to practice.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and this sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure. And when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.